Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
I'm Jim Dolan, your host on the RTC Weekly Download. This week, I think we'll have a little two-fisted action with Philip Marlowe and an episode called The Friend from Detroit from 1949.
When my telephone rang, it jerked me out of one nightmare and right into the middle of another, where a woman with a secret, a worried man, and a shadow out of the past met with fear and fury in the dead of night.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character as CBS presents The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. And now, with Gerald Moore, starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's exciting story, The Friend from Detroit.
There was a wood nymph dressed in nothing but a veil of dewdrops. She was pirouetting from one huge bluebell to another on gossamer wings. And with every turn, she smiled and came closer. But just as I reached out for a hand, something happened. The bluebells changed into old tomato cans and started to ring. A bandy-legged little man with a jackhammer went to work on my head. I fell over a cliff, and just before I landed on a red-hot pile of Rook and Scotch bottles... Oh, I woke up. But the jackhammer didn't stop. I switched on the light and looked at my watch. It was 1 in the a.m., and the phone on my bed table was screaming for an answer. Hello?
Marlowe, this is Dave. Betty's gone. She's in trouble. You gotta help me, Marlowe. You gotta come over to my apartment right away.
Wait a minute. Who is this?
Dave Pryor. I run the coffee joint in the corner. You know me.
Oh, yeah, sure, Dave. I remember. What's the matter?
My wife, Betty, she's gone. You gotta help me.
Dave, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm in bed. Besides, you know I don't monkey with family quarrels.
It's not like that. Phil, believe me, I'm scared for her. Phil, please, come over to the apartment. 2000 Beechwood right away. It's
okay,
a matter of life.
Okay, I'll be there in 10 minutes.
Marlowe, I thought you'd never get here. Look, somebody fired a shot through the door, and when I got back with the aspirin, Betty was gone.
All right,
and
wait a minute, Dave. Hold it. I'm not even awake yet. Look, sit down. Take it from the top. Slow.
Yeah, okay. Maybe it started this morning at the coffee joint when a fancy guy came in and talked to Betty. She waits on the table.
Yeah, I know. What do you mean, fancy?
Well, a slick dress, a cufflink, stick pin, all that. I didn't know him, and Betty tossed him off to me as a masher. Maybe he was, but she seemed upset.
Slower,
by him.
Huh?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, tonight about 9, another guy came in, a chunky bird with a deep voice. Betty had just got back from shopping, and I was in the kitchen. See, when I heard a tray of dishes fall, and Betty came back white as a sheet. She was scared, Phil, scared,
Hey!
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. Go ahead.
I looked out, and that chunky guy was leaving. Betty insisted he had nothing to do with it, that she was just nervous.
Was somebody else in the place at the time?
Let's see. Yeah, some Tribune reporter that comes in every night was up at the counter. He was the only one.
And Betty stayed on the job till you closed, huh?
Yeah, till midnight. But, Phil, she was in a bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
After we got home here, she sent me out for some aspirin. I was only out for 15 minutes, Phil. When I came back, she was gone. And look, this bullet hole in the glass door to the backyard. Somebody out there shot at her and maybe hit her
or
something.
All right, Dave, steady. Now take it easy. You and Betty have a gun?
No. Why?
Well, in the first place, the bullet went out through this glass. It didn't come in. And another thing, Dave, who did you call tonight after you phoned me?
Why, nobody.
Phone directory on the dresser here is open to the bees. Boone to Wardrobe. Mean anything to you?
No, I didn't even realize it was over there. I looked you up in the classified.
Mm-hmm. Okay, come on, let's take a look in the backyard. Any light out there?
Yeah, I rigged one up for the barbecue. Look, Marlowe, there must
take
be
it
something
easy.
You...
Now, we'll straighten this out, believe me. Let's see. Line of sight seems to run somewhere between the barbecue and the gate. No footprints, though, maybe.
Marlowe.
Hmm?
Marlowe, here by the tree. It's a hat. Gray snap brim, initials V. VR on the sweatband.
VR. Mean anything to you?
Why, no. Sure. That's Van Remini's hat. He's the newspaper guy I told you about.
Tribune reporter that was in your place tonight?
Yeah.
Why should he be dodging bullets in your backyard?
I don't know.
Dave, where's Betty from?
Detroit. When she came out here, I gave her a job.
And then you both fell for each other and got married, huh?
Yeah, 2 years ago next month. And we've been happy, Phil. We've been...
Yeah. Now, look, Dave. Why did you call me instead of the cops?
I guess I'm afraid she's mixed up in something bad.
You know, if it turns out that way, I'll have to call him myself.
Okay, Phil. But you're on my side until you know for sure.
Yeah. All right, now you stay here, close to your phone.
Okay.
I'll check with you. Right now, I got to get a line on a bareheaded reporter. He can get us started if he hasn't lost anything more than his hat when I find him. So long, Dave. A reporter's hat, two strangers, and a bullet hole somehow added up to the fast fate of a hard-working kid named Betty, whose husband's only claim to fame was selling the best cup of coffee in town. It made no sense, but as I walked up the street toward my car, I figured that through Van Remini, I could get to the first answer. I was wrong. The first answer got to me. A thick hedge suddenly sprouted arms. One jerked me around while the other held the cold throat of a .45 against my throat.
Your car registration tag says your name is Philip Marlowe.
No kidding. How do you suppose that happened?
But it doesn't mention your racket. Shamus, maybe?
Could be. And you?
I'm a tourist.
Oh, sure. Just out to see the sights.
That's
huh?
it. One in particular. $25,000 that belongs to me. I don't want any interference from you or that square inside there.
You mean Dave Pryor?
I mean Dave Pryor. I'll go back in there and tell him to cool off. The little woman is all right. She's just helping an old friend, you might say.
Might I say you're the friend?
Never mind. Unless Mr. Jitters in there kicks up a fuss, everything will be fine. Betty knows what she's doing. She's got a lot of talent for it. Too much to waste slinging hash. And remember what I said, Marlowe. Lay off.
I'll remember more than that about you, Foghorn.
Just remember to count 10 before you move, boy.
Well, there's no point in trying to outsmart a 45. And with three steps, Foghorn vanished in the night. Also gone was a big chunk of my respect for a doll named Betty Pryor and a taste in old friends. Just so I wasn't jumping to conclusions, I went to my car and drove down to Hollywood Boulevard. At the first all-night gas station, I stopped and put in a call to the Tribune. A guy on the desk told me, through a mouthful of mangled cigar, that unless Remini was at Bungalow 24, Beverly Crest Hotel, covering the murder of an ex-Detroit hood, he was fired, and he hung up. But the one word Detroit made the call a jackpot, so I headed for the hotel on the double. It was pink and Spanish and squatted in a grove of well-behaved palm trees at the edge of a domesticated jungle, which gave the illusion of privacy to a string of bungalows that weren't. But number 24 had all the privacy of a glass-faced cutaway beehive when I pulled up in the middle of two squad cars and an ambulance and went inside. Sprawled on the floor in front of a desk was a very well-dressed Exhibit A. Complete with cufflinks and stick pin and presiding as usual was Detective Lieutenant Ibarra, who didn't see me until I walked up beside him.
What are you doing here, Marlowe?
I can smell blood clear across town. What's the story, Ibarra?
The name is Speck Willard, a gambler from Detroit. Retired out here to California a few years back to play horses and women. He was shot to death at about 8 o'clock tonight by a person or persons unknown.
Another gang jam?
No, I don't think so. Looks more like armed robbery that got out of hand.
How so?
We found a currency wrapper from a local bank that read $25,000 in an open drawer in the bedroom. And one of the bellhops saw a woman, unidentified so far, run out of here about the time the coroner says that Willard was shot.
A woman?
Yeah. That fits because he was known to be quite a nightclubber and general playboy. You wouldn't happen to know something about this woman, would you, Marlowe?
Me? Certainly not. No, I'm after a man, a live one, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, Marlowe, take this nickel.
Hmm?
In case you should just happen to hear something, I want you to spend that on a phone call to the police department. Now, who is it you're looking for?
A Tribune reporter named Van Remini. You know him?
Unfortunately, that's him over there, the sticky-fingered one by the window, swiping that book of matches just now, the one without a hat.
Oh, yeah, I know. Thanks, Lieutenant. I'll see you. Hey, Remini, can I talk to you a minute?
Yeah, sure. What's on your mind?
I'm Philip Marlowe, private detective.
Don't apologize. What's up, Marlowe?
Know a girl named Betty Pryor?
Pryor?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. She and her husband run a one-arm joint on Franklin, don't they?
That's right, Remini. I understand Betty got into a little trouble tonight. Heard about it?
Nope. Wouldn't worry, though. Trouble's not new to Betty.
Yeah, that's one popular school of thought. Incidentally, you seem to be going a long ways out of your way on this run-of-the-mill murder story, Remini.
You're taking a long way around to the point, pal. Get with it. I'm in a hurry.
Okay, pal. But keep it under your hat. Won't you? The gray one, I mean.
Oh, so that's how
it is. Yeah, that's the way it is, yeah. Now, do you mind telling me what you saw in Pryor's backyard tonight?
You name it. Shall I play dumb or lie?
Suit yourself.
See, my press card's just as good as your license, sweetheart. It gets me in, gets me out again. In my dodge, that's called reporting.
Remini, I'll squeeze the truth out of you eventually.
Sorry, I can't wait. I've got a deadline. Anything else?
Yeah, one thing, a match.
Yeah, sure, Marlo, anytime.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And, Remini.
Yeah?
Don't hang on too long, huh? Liable to singe your pinkies. The reporter blew out the match and looked at me steadily for a moment. And his lips shaped a word I ignored. Then he walked away. I had seen enough of the book of matches he'd stolen to know it was in the Starkist room, a glossy, glass-roofed dine, dance, and drink emporium near Arthur Murray's studio on Wilshire Boulevard. So I made like I was in for the night and watched Remini leave. All the way to his car, he kept looking back over his shoulder as if he expected to be followed. I waited till he was out of sight, and then I headed for Wilshire in the Starkist room. But when I got there, it was closed. Remini's car wasn't in the neighborhood, and the only thing that kept the trip from being a total loss was a spotlighted picture. 10 feet square of a sultry, svelte chanteuse labeled Carla Borden, whose come-on-in smile and almost costume was a cinch to increase the accident rate of the block by 20%. But then I took another look at her name and got back to business. It started with a B, as in phone book, opened to Boone and Bordeaux. I found a directory, got it open to Boone and Bordeaux, and halfway down the page was Borden, Carla, 2840 North Lucerne. It took 10 minutes to get there and 2 more to find out that she had an apartment, number 17, at the end of the first floor hall. The door was open and I started for it, but ducked back close to the elevator when a woman came out and ran down the corridor toward me. It was Betty Pryor. Hold it, Betty! Whoa!
What? Marlowe, what are you...
Never mind the stall, Betty. I've been in a long time.
Why, I don't know what you're talking about.
Now, look,
about.
You left a pretty worried guy at home.
Dave, did he send you after me?
That's right.
Why can't you fools leave me alone? Why does he have to be so stupid?
Hey, you've got a few ideas mixed up, kid.
Oh, sure, I'm wrong. I'm the one who's all mixed up. Let go of
Not
me, you...
Not until I've got a couple of things straight. Now, what happened? Did life in a hamburger stand get a little stale?
Yes, you two-bit snoop.
Okay. Dave thinks you're in trouble. I think you're in trouble, and I think somebody waved a few bills at you, and you lost your grip.
Why?
And you're in so deep now you can't get out, and it's no more than you deserve. Now, come on. We're going right back down the hall to Carla's apartment. We're going to have a little chat, just the three of us.
No, I won't let go.
Come on.
Take your hands off, Marlo. Stand still.
Well, my two chums, the Foghorn and its .45 caliber equalizer.
Easy does it. You were lucky the first time. Well, Betty, did you get it?
No, something went wrong. Something terrible went...
Shut up. Marlo isn't deep. We'll talk after he's out of the way. All right, you. Get in that elevator, chum. And we'll wait right here to see you leave. Go on, get in.
That .45 makes you awful brave, chum.
This way we don't offend a lady by being uncouth. And you get a chance to go up in the world. Just put your finger on a button.
Now, wait a
Come
minute.
Come on. All right. Now, all you have to do is push.
In just a moment, we will return to the second act of The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. But first, the most famous neighbors in radio, the Ronald Colemans, will pay Jack Benny a visit again tomorrow as CBS's Great Sunday Night gets underway with another star-studded group of famous entertainers. Amos and Andy, Lum and Abner, Eve Arden as the gay schoolmistress, our Miss Brooks, and Helen Hayes as a hillbilly. These are only 4 more of the 10 great entertainments which will come your way tomorrow night. Go visiting with the Colemans on all of these same stations on The Jack Benny Show and hear the rest of CBS's Great Sunday Night 10 as they come one by one over most of these stations. And now, with our star, Gerald Moore, we return to the second act of Philip Marlowe and tonight's story, The Friend from Detroit.
My cage on cables was 10 exasperating seconds getting to the next floor. And I was another 10 getting free of it, back down the stairs and out into the dark street where the red splash of a taillight disappeared around a corner. And that was all that was left of Foghorn and Company. So I turned back toward Carla Borden's room. When I stepped across the threshold, I found that with the exception of a single bureau that was still intact, apartment number 17 looked like it had just played host to the vortex of a cyclone. The bed, a chest of drawers, another bureau, a desk, everything was inside out. And in the middle of all that was the body of Carla Borden. Blood from a deep, ugly cut on her head, staining the snow-white front of her Angora sweater. But I saw something else, which reminded me that this was not the first corpse of the night. The plush leather frame was shaped like an oversized lifesaver, and in it was the picture of a handsome man, all smiles, inscribed, "With love to my very best girl, Speck Willard." It was 10 minutes before I got Tennity Barra, who was still up at the Beverly Crest Hotel. And after I told him about Carla and her connection with the late Mr. Willard and Betty Pryor and my connection with Dave, I stopped talking and listened.
Marla, we just learned that Willard had some kind of a $25,000 caper going with one of his old mobster friends from Detroit, named Joe Lazar.
Who maybe is something with a voice and active below bottom?
The same, Phil. Anyhow, it looks like they worked out a gambling deal for old time's sake. At the last minute, Willard tried to welch on Lazar and got killed for his trouble. Then Lazar searched the place until he found the $25,000.
No. That part doesn't fit, Ibarra.
How so?
Well, I've run into Lazar twice tonight. I know he and the money are still strangers.
Oh?
After what happened here with the team of Betty and Lazar getting to the singer Carla, I figure they're still looking for it. Also, I figure Carla was somewhere near when Lazar killed Speck Willard, and that she took the money and... Call you later, Ibarra. I got clumsy company in the hall outside. All right, ballerina, get your foot out of that bucket and come on in with your hands up. Well, the man with a very long nose for news. What brings you around, Remini?
For one thing, the fact that you got no corner on brains, Marlowe, and for another, who did that to her?
Our mutual friend, Betty Pryor, and her running mate. I believe they were looking for $25,000.
Did she and Joe Lazar get the money, Marlowe?
No, they... Hey, Remini, how did you know the man with Betty was named Joe Lazar?
Haven't you heard? I'm a good reporter, Marlowe. The kind that keeps eyes and ears open and mouth shut. It isn't until I know the whole story.
Which, as far as you're concerned, is precisely what?
That I happen to
be... You happen to be?
That I happen to be in Dave's restaurant early this evening where I recognize the only other cash customer is Joe Lazar.
Oh.
An out-of-work mobster from Detroit. He said something to Betty that scared her right out of a tray of dishes, so I figured I'd find out what was going on. I've been in on the show ever since.
Yeah, including a corny blackout up at 2000 Beechwood Drive where you lost your hat running away from a bullet.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And just so you don't toss and turn when you get around to going to bed tonight, I'll fill in the rest. I followed Betty and Dave from the restaurant to their apartment. I watched her get rid of Dave, and then when I saw Lazar come in, I moved up close to the window.
And stayed there until Lazar spotted you and threw a bullet your way?
You're very clever.
Yes, I am, man.
But before that happened, I heard him tell Betty that Speck Willard had talked about a girl singer at the Starkiss Room named Carla Borden. And that since he didn't know Carla on sight, she could have been the lady he'd seen running out of Speck's apartment with a 25 grand.
Oh. Now that phone book of Dave's open to the bees ties in.
I'm so glad. Now, Marlowe, lest we digress too far, how come this one bureau here hasn't been turned upside down along with everything else?
I don't know. Any more than I know why you're holding back so much from the law.
Well, maybe it's because I don't like cops, Marla. Oh, black ones. Or maybe it's because I'm in the same kind of racket as you. Chin way out and a lot of fast talk, just so papers can know what's going on an hour ahead of the rest of the world. Well, there's no $25,000 in here. I got to blow.
Before Ibarra shows?
Before Ibarra shows. He always arrives with an entourage, Marla, one that includes other newshounds. So it's me for a fast cab in downtown to my paper with a story. Come on, fella. I'll see you around.
Hey, wait a minute, Remini.
Yeah?
I'll give you a lift. I'm going that way myself.
Okay.
I got a story, too. A lousy story. I've got to tell a nice guy named Dave. Come on. All the time we drove, Remini half-faced me and smoked one cigarette after another while he rattled on about Joe Lazar. The great story he had and a lot of other things I didn't hear because I was busy trying to find the right words with which to tell Dave Pryor that his wife was no good. So when we were about halfway to Beechwood Drive and Remini, who was pushing close to his deadline, decided to get out and phone his story in from a drugstore, I was glad.
So long, Marlowe.
Second after that, I knew I was kidding myself. Because even with just silence for company, I was still no place with the right words. Minutes later, when I stood in front of Dave on the steps to his house and stammered out the facts just as I had run across them, I forgot about words, right or wrong. A thought instead about my client, a badly hurt guy. But one who would never say die.
Marlowe, I can't believe all this. I won't. Tell me, where's Betty now?
I don't know, Dave. Now look, maybe we ought to head for police headquarters, because sooner or later we're each going to have a story to tell Lieutenant Ibarra. Come on, my car's over here.
Okay, Phil. I guess that's the only thing to do, all right?
Yeah, I guess so. Here. Better have a cigarette, David.
Oh, thanks.
Kid, we'll try to make this as painless as we...
As we what, Marlowe? What is it?
Hmm?
Well, what are you staring at?
Front seat.
But I don't see anything, Phil. What is it? What
are
you staring at?
Shut up, Dave. Shut up. Give me a minute, will you? Yeah. Yeah, sure. Come on, Dave. Pile in.
But why, Marlowe? Where are we going?
Ah, kiss room to play a long shot. Slapped my foot down hard on the accelerator and kept it that way right through a string of I didn't care what color traffic lights until 5 minutes later when we screeched to a stop away from the side entrance to the Star Kiss room. I left Dave in the front seat, piled out fast, and ran a dozen yards to an abrupt halt at the sight of something that turned the long shot I was playing into an odds-on favorite. It was the stage entrance door open a couple of inches, and in front of that and unconscious on the hard sidewalk where it had fallen was the clad in blue form of a private patrolman, his pistol holster conspicuously empty. Inside, I slowly picked my way along an L-shaped corridor until I saw a shaft of bright yellow from a flashlight that was moving away from a door marked Carla Borden. It brought me up short and flat against the wall. But then as the man on the other end of the beam of light moved away from me, I got a very steady grip on the .38 in my pocket and started after him. A minute later, he entered the main room of the club, and it was there, as he started across the glass ceiling dance floor, that I recognized the very self-confident gait of a very self-confident guy. And that made the next move mine.
Bar's closed, what? Remini, and don't move, Buster. I'll blow your head off.
Ah. Looks like you're making news this time, good reporter. Or isn't that package in your hand the 25 grand you just found in Carla Borden's dressing room, huh? The same Carla Borden you murdered not an hour ago in an apartment on Lucerne, where you first thought the money was, where Betty Pryor surprised you before you could finish searching, where you later returned in the role of an All-American newsboy so you could get to that last bureau.
All right, I've heard enough, Marlowe. But I'm not going to stick around for more details.
You make a break and I'll shoot, Remini.
Try it, Eagle.
Stop, Remini, stop!
Nice shooting, Marlowe. But don't turn around, because where I'm standing, it's dark. And where you're standing, it's light. Now throw your gun away, fella. Come on, toss it! That's better. All right, Betty. Get over to that dead newspaper guy and get the money. Right. We'll take care of the private detective here.
What do you mean, take care, Joe? I can't go along with murder.
Speck Willard's death didn't seem to bother you any.
Shut up, Marlowe.
Speck Willard! Joe, you killed...
Yes, I killed Speck, that Wiltshire. 8 o'clock tonight. And I had to stay undercover, but still get my hands on the money. So, I came to you for help. I didn't tell you about the killing, because I didn't think you'd play ball if you knew about it. Now, all that's history now, and I'll still go to your dear husband, Dave, and talk lots about the kind of cheap kid you used to be in Detroit if you don't get moving. Now, what do you say, Betty?
I say no, Joe. I also say I made a mistake in the first place, letting you use me to run your filthy errands, just so the guy I love wouldn't have to know about the kind of people I once ran around with. Before I had any brains.
All right. That's the dumb way you want it. That's the dumb way it'll be. Taking care of two years is much harder than taking care of one.
What about three, Lazar?
Dave,
stay back!
No, Marlowe, no. I've stayed back too long already. I've stayed back while Betty has been risking her life to protect what we've got.
If you take another step, I'll shoot, kid. I'm warning you for the last time. Stay back!
No, Lazar, I won't!
You thinking scum, Lazar!
Oh, Dave, you're hit!
Yeah. Yeah. But I'll be all right. I'll be all right now, Betty.
Dr. Reese, please report to surgery.
Well, Mrs. Pryor.
Dr. Reese.
Marlowe, the doctor says that Dave's going to be fine in a couple of days.
Yeah.
Caught one on the shoulder, the other on the hip.
He certainly had courage, didn't he?
Yeah, and you did all right, too, Betty. Mixing in this whole mess just to keep the home fires burning? Tell me, whatever made you think that a guy like Dave wouldn't understand that you turned over a new leaf?
Well, Dr. Reese wanted in surgery. I don't know, Phil. I guess I wasn't very smart.
No, you weren't, Mrs. Pryor, but you're lucky because Marlowe here was. And that brings me around to a loose end, Phil. How did you know that Remini was your man?
No, that. Because of something I saw in the upholstery of the front seat of my car, Ibarra. Tufts of snow-white angora, which was the kind of sweater that Carla Borden had on when she was murdered after they struggled.
And since you didn't touch the body yourself, they couldn't have come from your suit.
No. And Remini was the only other one who had been in my car. So I figured that the angora fuzz had gone from Carla's sweater to Remini's suit to my upholstery.
Yeah.
All of which means that Remini must have been in Carla's room before I got there as well as after. See? And then once I thought back about his getting out of my car to phone his story in, I realized that when I dropped him near a drugstore, he had also been near the Starkist room.
Yes. That's exactly where he'd headed.
Mm-hmm.
You see, Phil, Joe and I followed both of you from Carla Borden's place because, well, after Joe put you in that elevator and we ran, Joe said we had to return and wait for Remini, who was sure to come back and finish his search.
And the whole business because Lazar, after he had murdered Speck Willard, was afraid to publicly go after Carla Borden. And the money he felt was his.
Yes. He knew about me and Dave because Speck Willard accidentally dropped into our place this morning.
Correction,
for...
baby.
What?
Yesterday morning.
Oh.
It's now 9 a.m. Oh! And a good time to call quits, huh? Good night, kids. By the time I got back to my apartment on Franklin, it was 10:30 in the too bright morning. I was sporting sandpaper eyelids and a knot in the small of my back that felt like a wet dish rag. Oh, but once I had all the shades down and was undressed and in bed, I forgot about that. And I thought instead of the wood nymph dressed in nothing, but a veil of dewdrops. But then suddenly I stopped. The telephone. I got out of bed. I picked it up with both hands, opened the dresser drawer, and jammed it deep under all the socks I owned. And then I got back to bed. And the wood nymph, in her veil of dewdrops. She was pirouetting from one huge bluebell to another. Oh, my. On gossamer wing.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, created by Raymond Chandler, stars Gerald Moore, and is produced and directed by Norman McDonald. Script is by Mel Dinelli, Robert Mitchell, and Gene Levitt. Featured in the cast were Virginia Gregg as Betty Pryor, Peter Leeds as Dave Pryor, Harry Bartell as Van Remini, and Ed Begley as Joe Lazar. Lieutenant Detective Ibarra was played by Jeff Corey. The special music was by Richard O'Runt. Be sure and be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
It was a hunt through a jungle of city streets with danger waiting at every intersection until halfway through when the hunters became the hunted and death brought an end to the game.
Coleman's visiting Jack Benny, plus Amos and Andy, Eve Arden, and Helen Hayes as a hillbilly. Yes, that earlier announcement about CBS programs tomorrow night sounded great, didn't it? Except, you Philip Marlowe fans may have been wondering, isn't there a mystery show among that great Sunday night 10 on CBS? Of course there is. One of the great detectives in the mystery world, Dashiell Hammett's one and only Sam Spade. Sam will be here, hard-hitting, fast-moving as always, tomorrow night on most of the same CBS network stations. This is Roy Rowan speaking. Now, stay tuned for Gangbusters, which follows immediately over most of the same CBS stations. is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Next here on the RTC Weekly Download, we have an episode of Medical File. Now, this is a program that came from South Africa, and it's an interesting subject matter. This one is called Life in the Dark, from December 2 of 1969.
This is a true story, taken from an actual medical file.
I put the tray down there, nurse. Well, Jim, we're going to remove the bandages and change the dressings. It could be that you'll be able to see a little this morning, be able to observe some faint outlines. On the other hand, it may be early yet, too early. Whatever it is, I don't want you to be disappointed.
I don't know about being disappointed, Doctor. Right now, I'm just plain scared.
That morning of September the 4th, 1956, I'd been 12 years in the dark. Perhaps I'd grown used to it, grown to depend on it, built my way of life around it. I hadn't seen for 12 years, and all the people who made up my existence were people whose faces I had never known. Was it strange that, for one frightened moment, I wanted to leave the bandages alone and let that world of mine stay undisturbed?
Bristol Myers, makers of Clairol hair care products, Ipana toothpaste, and Score Clear Hair Cream for Men, take great pleasure in presenting Medical File. Factual stories of the men and women whose vigilance guards our lives. A reconstruction of clinical case histories, step by step with the doctors who were there. Tonight, you'll hear the story Life in the Dark in Medical File.
Anti-cavity Ipana toothpaste has a secret weapon against decay. Its unique tooth defenders set up a germ-proof defense around each tooth. Ipana's germ barrier stays put for hours, won't rinse or wash away.
We're against tooth decay. That's why we're for anti-cavity Ipana.
Join the Ipana Brigade!
Clear Score, a clean winner! The clean look is in, man, in. Greasy hair is out, man, out.
Score Groom is clean. Groom breaks free, man, you score.
Man, you need Score, the water-mixable hair groom that says goodbye to greasy hair. Break free, man, use Score.
Score Groom is clean. Groom breaks free, man, you score.
Christmas Eve, 1944. Somewhere, I suppose, they were singing carols in the streets. But not where we were. We'd been attacking the hill since the first light of that day. Now it was late afternoon.
If somebody doesn't get that blasted gun up on the hill, it's going to get us.
Take it easy, Eddie. They're trying. They've been trying all day.
Unmissed machine gunners and a stinking mortar. And we're held up out here in the open.
It's never easy to take a hill like this one.
Stupid fools shining up their pants. Couldn't they have planned a way to go round it? Look out!
Oh, that was close.
Too darn close. We're like sitting ducks.
Here's another. Get down!
They've got the range.
Where's Morgan?
Steve, find out from Morgan what's happening.
Yes, either we go forward or back, but let's get out of here.
Look out there! Eddie, down! You all right in there? Hey, Eddie! Jim!
You all right? Oh, brother. Hey, stretcher bears! Stretcher bears!
And these two we've kept on liquid diet, sir.
Good. Now, about this man here.
Private James Wilson, C Company, 221st Battalion.
Let me see that card, will you?
Oh, here, Major.
Oh, thanks. Well, Private Wilson, how do you feel today?
I'd feel a lot better if somebody told me whereabouts I am.
You're in base hospital. I'm Major Lewis. You were brought down here from the emergency field station 2 days ago.
Base hospital? It feels good.
Then you're feeling better.
Anything would be better than being up there.
Pretty bad, I hear.
Bad enough for me. I'm no hero.
Who is?
What have they got these bandages around my face for?
You were injured by a mortar explosion. There's been some damage to your eyes.
Oh, yes. They hurt like the devil. So does my head.
You very nearly didn't make it, Wilson. According to your card, a shell exploded almost on top of you.
What about the others? Eddie Thompson, Steve, rest of my patrol.
We don't know anything here. Just relax now, Private. Get plenty of rest.
How bad are my eyes?
We won't know for a while yet.
Am I going to be able to see?
Now, that's a question I can hardly answer.
Why not?
Because I'd prefer to leave it for the experts. Now, don't worry, Wilson. You've had a bad time, and your eyes have been affected in some way by that explosion. That I won't deny.
Why are the bandages on? For heaven's sake, why won't somebody tell me?
You've had a slight operation. When you were brought in, there were shell fragments in each eye. Small ones. They had to be removed. Don't worry, Wilson. You'll get the best attention we can possibly give you.
Three weeks later, mid-January 1945, I was invalided back to the General Hospital. There were bandages still around my eyes. I'd been in the dark ever since that moment on Christmas Eve. And when they finally removed the bandages, I was still in the dark. They took them off one morning. I could hear the birds singing outside the windows of the ward. Somehow I knew the sun was shining, but I didn't see it. No, that wasn't the first time I knew I was blind. I think I'd known it all along. That day was simply the day that hope ran out.
Sit down here, Wilson. Can you make it? There's the chair.
I'll make it.
Yes, we're good man.
Oh, I'm getting quite expert. Another few months and I'll be an authority on all kinds of things. Like finding my way in the dark and sensing when people are near and making baskets.
We've put you through a lot of tests.
The lot, surely. It seems like weeks you've been testing me for one thing or another.
Well, it is weeks.
Does it amount to anything?
I've got some news for you, Wilson.
You don't have to take it easily with me, Doc. I've known for weeks that I'm blind, and I'm going to stay blind. Well, aren't I?
The right eye will have to be removed.
Removed?
Yes, have to be taken out. It's been injured beyond repair. By leaving it in, we only take pointless risks.
And the other eye? The left?
Well, there's an operation which entails removal of the cataract-clouded lens. I think we could perform that in 4 or 5 months' time. There's no reason at all why it shouldn't be partially successful.
Partially?
So that you can distinguish light and shade and see large objects from a close distance.
Well, that would be something.
It's not a lot. I wish I could promise more.
I was 8 months in hospital before the operations were finally complete. At the end of that time, my vision was about 5/200ths. It meant that from 5 feet away, I could see the big letter E at the top of the sight chart. 5 feet. I should have been able to see it from 200. November 1945. I was due to leave hospital. I had a last examination from Dr. Bedson.
Well, Jim, We're going to miss your cheery face around here. And I'm not kidding, it is a cheerful face. A lot different to when you came here.
Yes, a year nearly. You get to accept things.
Yes, I know.
What's the eye look like now, Doc?
About the same, Jim. We can detect scraps of metal floating around the inside of the eye, and there's a membrane of scar tissue blocking your sight. But the answer is still the same, Jim. We can't operate any further for fear of destroying the sight of the eye completely.
Look, Doctor, I'm as good as blind. I can't read. I have to count steps so I won't fall down. I can't walk in crowds without help. Don't you think I might like to take that risk?
It'd be a risk for no purpose, Jim. The operation wouldn't succeed.
I see.
Yes, you keep on getting flashes of hope, don't you? Like the time you heard about those corneal transplants.
The time you had to explain to me that was only for people with a scarred or diseased cornea of the eye. But my trouble was deeper.
Jim, we've been over all this before. I'm a lot more interested in what you're going to do when you get out of here.
Well, let's see if you react like all the others.
Hmm?
I'm going back to college to study. I want to go on with the course I had to drop when I joined up. I want to be a school teacher.
That's fine.
You didn't laugh.
Why should I?
You know why you should. You know why the others did. A blind man going back to school.
I think it's pretty wonderful.
Thank God you said that.
Jim...
I was beginning to think I was the only one who believed it possible. I was beginning to think that perhaps I was stepping too high.
You get in there and show them. And Jim...
Yes?
I hope we run into each other someday.
So do I, Doctor. Yes, so do I.
Sit down, Mr. Wilson. There. Can I help you?
No, it's all right, thank you, sir.
Wilson, I'm going to wish you the same as I wish every student at the beginning of a new year. I'm going to wish you luck.
Thank you, Professor.
We have to discuss your handicap for a few moments now to make certain arrangements. And thereafter, we won't refer to it again.
That's the way I want it, sir.
You'll be treated like any other student. If you fail to turn up at your lectures, you'll get short shift from me, the same as anyone else.
Thank you, sir.
Now then, you're going to need somebody to help you in your reading. I understand you have a slight amount of vision.
I might be able to read big headline print with a magnifying glass.
Then obviously you're going to need help. Can you afford to pay someone?
Yes, sir. I have my college fees paid and a full pension.
Well, there are plenty of students working their way through and others anxious to supplement their spending money. I don't think we'll have any trouble getting someone to read with you and help you study. I look through the lists and see who's put their name down for additional college posts.
Come in. Yes? Who is it?
Mr. Wilson? I'm Ann Field. Professor Norman said you need a reader.
Oh, will you sit down, Miss Field? I'm afraid the room's in a bit of a mess. I've been trying to put my clothes away.
You sit down. Let me do it.
Now, hold on a moment. I want to employ you as a reader, not a professional valet.
Never mind, just for one. Sit down and let me take care of it.
I don't have to be helped.
Oh, when it comes to unpacking clothes, all men have to be helped, and you're no different to anyone else.
I'm glad you said that.
Well, you're not, are you? Sit down and stop arguing. Let me fix this mess.
Her name was Ann Field, and she was 22 years old. She had a way of helping me do things that never made me awkward or embarrassed, the way it so often did with others. We studied English and history together, and she read my textbooks for me all that autumn and winter, and the following spring. The end of the year celebration was our engagement party. A few months later, we were married. For the first time since that day in Italy, when I lost my sight, I could see that there was going to be a future.
Clear score, a clean winner. The clean look is in, man, in. Greasy hair is out, man, out.
Score room is clean, room break free, man, you score.
Man, you need the water mixable hair groom that says goodbye to greasy hair. Break free, man. Use Score.
Score groomed. It's clean groomed. Break free, man. Use Score. Join the anti-cavity campaign. Join the Ipana Brigade.
New anti-cavity Ipana toothpaste have a secret weapon against decay. Its unique tooth defenders set up a germ-proof defense around each tooth. Ipana's germ barrier stays put for hours, won't rinse or wash away.
We're against tooth decay. That's why we're for anti-cavity Ipana.
Join the Ipana Brigade.
As English master at a small private school, I stayed there 2 years and then applied for and was accepted at a larger and better known college. I was learning to live with my handicap, but it was still an ordeal to meet people for the first time, especially someone like Henry Miller, the principal of Leicester College, who called me for an interview when my application was first being considered.
Well, let's discuss this quite frankly, Mr. Wilson. Just what degree of vision do you have at the present time?
Well, sir, when I left hospital in 1945, it was 5/200. I think it may be a little less than that now.
In fact, very little vision at all.
Yes, I'm afraid very little.
Yet the principal of your former school has given you a splendid reference. How do you merit it? Correcting study papers, for instance.
My wife went through college with me, sir. She reads the papers, and we mark them together.
And during class, how do you manage?
Memory. I know the syllabus by heart. I very soon get to know my students by their voices. It's worked out during the past few years. I think it can go on working.
I'm sure it can. Believe me, I was most impressed by your application. The job is open to you, Wilson.
Thank you, sir.
You will start at the beginning of term next week. And, by the way, we all have handicaps. I've got a gammy leg. Welcome to Leicester College, Mr. Wilson. I'm looking forward to working with you.
In 1950, I went to teach at Leicester College. I was still there 6 years later. I don't think it would be sheer emotion that makes me say those were the happiest years of my life. Somehow, all the things I'd ever wanted to be and do were there at Leicester. I was happy in my work, in my associates, relaxed and at ease with my students, and very much in love with my wife. I lived in the dark, but I was never alone.
Not much in the paper tonight, darling. The government being attacked again.
Nothing that won't be on the late night news bulletin. Oh, well, I'd better get you to go over those exam corrections, Anne. Young Rayner and Hendricks are coming round about it.
Seems to me we have at least a couple of your students around here nearly every night.
You don't mind, do you?
Mine? I love it. If it's not one of the boys, it's another master. And everyone who drops by makes me realize what a success you've made of this, Jim.
I couldn't have done it without your help.
You couldn't have done it without being the kind of person you are. I'll get those exam papers.
Thank you, my dear.
Strange.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I just noticed a name here in the paper. Benson, Dr. Gordon Benson.
Benson? Now, that was the name of the surgeon in the Army Hospital.
Listen. Visiting eye surgeon, Dr. Gordon Benson, who is in the city to give a series of lectures on new ophthalmic advances, dined yesterday with a select group of doctors when plans for a new eye clinic at the Royal Hospital were discussed. Oh, Jim, it sounds very like the same man.
You know, I think it is. Jove, he's come on in the world.
Yes, hasn't he?
Oh, Benson. He wasn't a bad sort. I remember he said he hoped we'd run into each other someday. Fancy me remembering that. Oh, it must be all of 12 years ago.
Why don't you drop him a line?
Now, if he's dining with a select group of doctors and lecturing, he won't want to be bothered with an old case history who happens to have become a school teacher.
Oh, I don't know. I think you're a very special old case history.
I doubt if he does. Benson must have had thousands of patients like me.
Well, just the same, he might like to hear. Why not write him a note? Send it care of the university.
Oh, I suppose I could.
Here, before your students turn up, I'll run a piece of paper into your portable, and you can dictate something.
You're very keen on this, aren't you? Look, Anne, don't get any ideas, darling.
Like what?
Like thinking that an eye specialist lecturing on advances in eye surgery might be able to do something for me.
Well, he might.
He made that point plain 12 years ago. There's nothing that can be done.
All right, Jim. Then we won't get any ideas. But let's drop him a line just the same.
We sent a letter off to Dr. Benson, and an answer came the following day. If I thought he'd forgotten me in a mass of case histories since then, I was far from right. He came to dinner two nights later, and he not only remembered, he was still interested. He insisted on making an examination while dinner was being prepared, and afterwards, over coffee, brought up the subject again.
You know, Jim, this is what I really enjoy. Meeting a man after so many years, finding him a success in every possible way. Yes, I remember when you left hospital, you were going to try and become a teacher. I often wondered what had happened to you.
Here's the reason for my success, Doctor.
Oh, yes, I can well believe it.
Now, that's not true. I only helped. Jim did the toughest parts alone. Like standing in front of a class he couldn't see for the first time. That takes a special kind of courage.
You've never seen your wife?
Only as a blurred shape.
Jim, when I examined your eye before dinner, I must confess I was, well, rather surprised.
Why, Doctor?
Because it's in such good condition. I would have expected deterioration, but, well, there's hardly any. Yes, do you know, I think we ought to operate.
What?
Operate, Dr. Benson?
I think there's a very good chance of improving the vision.
But you said 12 years ago...
Ah, yes, yes, Jim. 12 years ago, we didn't know about this new technique. The membrane that was formed at the time of your injury is what's blocking the sight. Well, I could cut through it. Now, the operation itself is quite simple. We've been doing it successfully over the past few years.
Yes, but what if it didn't work?
Then there's just a chance you'd lose the sight of the eye completely.
It's my last one. It may be only about 5% effective, but I'd be worse off without it.
I'd say the chances are 70 to 30 in favor of success. Oh, but look here, why don't you and Anne talk it over and give me an answer in a few days' time?
Do we need to talk about it?
No. No, I don't suppose we do. This was in the back of Anne's mind when she wrote to you, Doctor. And mine too, I suppose. Although I wasn't going to admit it. If there's a chance for me to see again, I want to take it. How soon can you operate?
The operation took place 2 days later. And 72 hours after that, the bandages were removed. I'll admit it, I was scared. All the people who made up my existence were people whose faces I had never seen more than as a blurred outline. I was scared of what I was going to see, and scared of not being able to see at all. And then the bandages came off, and all at once, I knew everything was going to be all right.
Jim?
Why didn't you tell me you were beautiful?
Oh, but I'm not.
The loveliest thing I've ever seen. Just stand there, darling. Don't move away. I want to go on looking.
Well, you're going to be able to look for the rest of your life, Jim. Now, how about letting me make a small examination?
You look fine too, Doc.
Thanks.
Is it going to last? I mean, really last?
Yes, it's going to last, Jim, all your life. You'll need strong glasses, of course, but you'll see as well as anyone else. Now, we're putting the bandages back on until the wounds heal completely. You'll just have to be patient for a few more days.
4 days after that, and the bandages came off for the last time. That afternoon, September the 8th, 1956, I went through my last examination from Dr. Benson and heard the final words of reassurance.
Wounds all healed, Jim. Vision is improved 75%. Well, I'm leaving for my hometown tomorrow, but you'll be perfectly all right now.
There's no way I can thank you, Doc.
No. Thanks aren't needed. I'm only sorry we didn't meet like this a few years ago. Perhaps we could have restored your sight that much sooner.
I've no regrets. Those 12 years in the dark taught me a new way to live. I think I'll be all the better for it.
Yes, I'm sure you will.
Oh, by the way, there's quite a view from this window.
Now he's showing off, Dr. Benson. Hmm? He's been staring at everything all over town like a country cousin.
What's so interesting down there, Jim?
I see by the neon sign across the street that they serve drinks. How about coming along and joining in a small celebration?
Anti-cavity Ipana toothpaste has a secret weapon against decay. Its unique tooth defenders set up a germ-proof defense around each tooth. Ipana's germ barrier stays put for hours, won't rinse or wash away.
We're against tooth decay. That's why we're for anti-cavity Ipana.
Join the Ipana Brigade!
Clear score, a clean winner. The clean look is in, man, in. Greasy hair is out, man, out.
Score, groomed is clean, groomed, break free, man, you score.
Man, you need Score, the water mixable hair groom that says goodbye to greasy hair. Break free, man, use Score.
Score, groomed is clean, groomed, break free, man, you score.
Medical File, the documented story of the men and women who in hospitals, research centers, and lonely surgeries guard our lives. Tonight's story was directed by John Seeliger and produced by David Manley. Listen again next week for another true story from Medical File.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.